Ladies and gentlemen from around the Delaware Valley, welcome to the Lawyer to Lawyer Network with Sonny Banks. We've got a phenomenal show today. Sonny, we are in an atmosphere. Joe Krause always says that radio is theater of the mind. Well, the atmosphere that we have here, the scenery is second to none. Tell our listeners where we're at.
Yeah, how about these digs?
Yeah, man. I mean, you know, you know what's funny about this? This would be a great radio, you know, radio studio for us to do it, and forget the station. You know, can you guys? I'm sure you can.
I was going to say he's pitching you guys big time.
This is fantastic. So tell our listeners where we're at.
We're on the 52nd floor of One Liberty, in the law firm of Saltz, Mongaluzzi, and Bendesky.
Outstanding, and we certainly have a great show. This place. They have a Bruce Springsteen exhibit in here. I walked right in. I'm a massive Bruce fan, so I was right at home.
It's like a museum.
One of our guests, Bob Zimmerman, was taking me for a tour. I'm like, Bob, slow down, man. No reason to, you know. I know he's at work, but he's taking. Whoa, hold on for a second. But we've got some great guests. We've got Bob Zimmerman, who's a partner at Saltz Mongaluzzi, and David Quass, who's also a partner at Saltz Mongaluzzi. Gentlemen, welcome to the broadcast.
Thank you for having us. We appreciate it.
Thank you so much. It's great to be with you.
It's great to have you both. I know, David, you've been preparing for the interview all night long. you're actually pinch hitting in the cleanup spot, and we really appreciate it. I'd like to, if we could, start off with Bob and remind our listeners a little bit about yourself and the firm.
Sure. So my name's Bob Zimmerman. I started at Saltz Mongaluzzi and Bendesky in 2008. I actually worked for Dave over here as his associate, and it was about 5 years or so we worked together.
Five glorious years.
Five glorious years.
Yeah. How much did you pay him to say that, Bob?
So, yeah, I've been here for 13 years, and, you know, my practice is mainly construction, workplace, product liability, and other catastrophic injuries.
David, if you would, tell us a little bit about yourself and about your specialty as well.
Well, thank you. Thank you, Joe. I'm a lot older.
By the way, you don't look a lot older.
No,
than
you
this.
Don't.
To me, personally, I was just going to say.
I don't appreciate that.
Stop. You both look great. It's just that, ironically, you look like you could be just getting out of law school there, David. You look fantastic.
Well, that's very kind of you to say. I wish that were the case. So I have been at this for 30 years. My first 8.5 years I spent actually as a defense lawyer, and I came to Saltz Mongaluzzi, thinking back now is in May of 1999, so I have been here over 22 years, and do very much the same sort of work that Bob does. We really focus a great deal on construction site accidents, and accidents involving defects in the machinery that can be at construction sites. So we do work with cranes and dozers and backhoe loaders and aerial lifts of various kinds, a lot of work involving construction machinery.
It's interesting because I think we had Bob Mongaluzzi on one of our shows and another one of your partners. And we talked, you know, being an iron worker, where we're sitting right now, let me just describe it to everybody. Like Sonny said, 52nd floor, the skyline. I mean, we're looking down, okay? And it's just an incredible view, ironically, a view that I'm extremely familiar with. And
thank God we're inside.
Yeah, no question. And even now,
like iron workers outside.
Well, here's the thing. And even and back when I was an iron worker, and I was an iron worker for 20-some years, safety was always one hand for the company, one hand for yourself. But mm-hmm. there wasn't static lines out there. We weren't tying off at all times. I look at the Blue Cross building, and I remember when they lowered me down through the core to work on some of the elevator structure. So having said that, you talk about the catastrophic injuries and I think it was Bob Mongaluzzi or another one of your associates at one of the shows. We talked about one of the first big cases. Now, this firm is nationally acclaimed, does incredible work for, you know, on catastrophic injuries, and that's the understatement of the century. But a guy by the name of Mike Whitland was an iron worker who I worked with on the Frankfurt L. He was my boss, and a fantastic human being. And he was, I think it was Bob or the other associate who told me that it was one of the first big cases that Saltz Mongoluzzi ever got, and that's what took the firm off. So Bob was working on the casino down in Atlantic City, and it fell on top of him. And I worked on the Frank Fidel with Bob for about 2 years. I mean, not Bob, but Mike Whitlin for a couple years. And you look at those types of cases, and as an iron worker, my father always sent. We weren't just getting strained backs. It's catastrophic injuries. I can't count on. I said at the beginning of the broadcast, we were looking over the city, and Bob Zimmerman was kind enough to mention that we put the curse on the city of Philadelphia when we put the Flyers jersey on Billy Penn, and one of those guys' names was Jack O'Brien. He lost his life, and we've had so you need a big time firm. When that happens, that can do all the investigating and all those things, David.
Because I would imagine in construction accident cases, you literally have to educate yourself about the various machinery and other equipment that causes the injury.
Talk about right? that, David.
Yeah, that's something about which I really feel very, very passionately. One of the things that we do on my team is that we try to go out and get ourselves. Into the machinery of the cases that we're working on. So we all go through training. We all go through certification training. We all try to make sure. So, I've been through aerial lift certification training. I've been through train the trainer training on aerial lifts. We've been through training on overhead cranes, on mobile cranes. You wouldn't really want me operating your crane, but in a pinch, I could move it a few inches without killing anybody. We've done forklift certification training. For the most part, we're all qualified riggers and qualified signal people. So we really do invest in ensuring that all of the attorneys and often all the staff on our team as well are operating the machinery, really understand what we do to try to have a better appreciation for just the sorts of hazardous work and hazardous situations that our clients can be in. Because fundamentally, Joe, all of the cases that we do come down to the defense argument trying to suggest that our own client did something stupid. Sure. Our own client knew better and did something stupid, right? And we're always trying to point out the ways in which our clients were either not appropriately trained for something, not given appropriate equipment, not given appropriate instruction, the amount of time that might have been necessary in order to safely accomplish the task. And so those are the things that we are frequently working with. But in terms of how we educate ourselves, as lovely as the offices are, and they're awesome,
right?
It's not good enough to just sit here and talk with people sometimes or to look at photographs or video.
It's a great approach.
Got to get out. Got to be at sites, got to operate the equipment, actually understand the way in which it
I mean, works. It's a great point. And what I get when you think about the catastrophic injuries and the emotions that when that phone rings and when you have something, Bob, is it you that's the you have a certification in, was it crane operator?
Dave actually hit it on the head. I mean, all of us, we handle these cases, and on the plaintiff side, you're representing an injured worker. On the defense side, the defense attorney will likely be representing a manufacturer, someone with a lot of experience on that product. So the defense attorney will time and time again handle, if it's a crane or an aerial lift or a forklift, they'll handle those cases 10, 20, 30 times. And for me, not only as what Dave said, getting your hands, on the machine, getting certified to operate the machine, but handling these cases over and over again, my fourth, fifth, sixth forklift case, I have a much greater appreciation for the product, for the documents that we need to get, to prove our case, than I did the first time. So it's a blessing to be able to represent people, who need our help. And to be able to use our experiential knowledge and frankly meet and hopefully exceed the knowledge of the defense attorneys who are handling these cases, you know, time and time again for the manufacturers.
Sonny, talk about that. You get, you know, an injured worker, and you think there may be a third-party element to it. How important is that in regards to when you're sending somebody to, a third party, you know, who has a third party case, and you know that you have individuals that are as qualified in the trades that the individual, the injured individual is in, as, you know, almost a tradesman. Talk about the advantage there.
Well, it's obviously huge, because I know that the folks at this firm aren't going to miss anything, you want to make sure that the client's rights, all of their rights, not only in the workers' compensation setting, but in a third-party setting, if there is a third-party component, are protected.
Let's talk about the process of soup to nuts, in a sense that when you get a case, a catastrophic case, and it's a mess, vetting that process at the beginning, what does that entail? Often, let's take a building collapse.
Getting out to the scene, on our side, oftentimes the clients may not get an attorney 1, 2, 3 days after an incident. They obviously it's an emotional time, but the defense, almost always in a major case, is going to have their lawyers on scene within hours of the accident. We have the benefit in some of our cases being out there right with them immediately. I was retained in a case about a month ago. We were retained on the 28th day after the accident, and we hired an investigator who went out to the site and was able to retrieve video from a neighboring store, which would have overridden itself in 30 days. Right. So if we didn't get...
So you had 2 days.
Retained, yeah, if we weren't retained on the 28th day, if we were retained on the 31st day, we would not have been able to get that video that was available. And that video is going to be very helpful and crucial to the case. So, when you talk about these big cases or, frankly, any workplace injury, it's about making sure that you send the right letters to the defendants, making sure that they're preserving evidence, and making sure you get out to the scene before the scene is altered. Because on construction sites, they're not going to sit there for 6 months or a year and just, stop working.
No.
You need to get out there immediately.
And you guys typically go yourselves as opposed to sending an investigator.
Yeah. I mean, on a construction site, absolutely. Yeah. It's so dynamic. Mm-hmm. You'll have so many different trades working there. I had a case down at the FMC tower where it was a terrible case. It involved a trip and fall where the individual had a screwdriver in his work bag, and it punctured him, and he ultimately died. Wow. And the issue was, in that area where he was working, were there tripping hazards? There were kickers for a wood form, and that wood form would have been gone within days. And if the family didn't retain an attorney quickly, that evidence will be gone. Now, they'll maybe take a picture, but they'll take a picture the way they want to take the picture. Sure. We're going to go there and actually look at the scene and kind of get all of the facts and the totality of the circumstances.
You're dealing with often emotional situations. And when the phone rings, obviously, there's a million different things. Obviously, you're dealing with getting out there and getting the evidence, number one. The culture at the firm, okay, not to say, it's extremely high level, but also putting the priority on having a bedside manner in dealing with individuals. Talk about that, because you're training to understand the industries of which you're representing individuals who have been hurt. But talk about the importance and what the conversations are like amongst the team in regards to dealing with clients in a sensitive way and having to be able to handle that situation as effectively as you do the research.
Well, the truth is, Joe, that that is one of the areas in which, even 30 years into this, I still feel like I'm growing and I'm learning, and I'm always needing to challenge myself to do better with that. But one of the things that we do here that is extremely important is that a lot of the folks who work here are from local families and come from trade families.
Right.
So they have brothers and sisters, sons or daughters, fathers, uncles who've been in the trades and who have a real appreciation for where the families are that are coming to us. In one of the cases, you know, on my team, we have a certified registered nurse whom I met over 20 years ago when her husband, who is a Philadelphia Pico gas crewman, was run over several times by a backhoe loader. And she went through the entire litigation process with us, discovery, surveillance, two failed mediations, and eventually to trial, as we tried to work to protect the rights of this horribly, horribly injured worker, her husband. And after that experience, she called me up and she said, you know, you guys do a real nice job, but one of the things that would improve what you do, make you even better, more effective, would be to understand even more about the full nature of your client's injuries. She said, I'd be willing to work with you, not as a client anymore, but as a consultant to help you better understand exactly what your clients are going through. So there was a period when she began that process. She's now come in-house with us. So she's here 4 days a week. And then on Fridays and Saturdays, she's still in clinic and she treats dozens and dozens of her own patients. But having somebody like that on the team, who is the wife of a tradesman injured on the job, who has been through the entire process as my client, and who can help to relate to the clients and help me relate to the clients, sure, is absolutely invaluable.
Setting expectations with the clients, the client experience, it starts at the beginning. I mean, they're often in the middle of, grief or a lot of different emotions. Bob, talk about that from day one, because, a firm with the resources that Saltz Mongoluzzi has, and they're a lot, it's not always David versus Goliath. You guys are one of the few firms that can match the insurance companies, and they know it. But having said that, it's still, insurance companies still just don't roll over. And it could be a rocky road. Talk about that client coming in the door. And maybe, at first they think, well, this is going to be a shut and, an open and shut case. It's not always that way. Talk about the importance of setting expectations from day one.
Yeah, I think, and Dave, you'd probably agree, our clients fall everywhere on the spectrum in terms of what they want to know and when. There are some clients who want to be updated very frequently as to the developments of a case. There are other clients who say to us, look, we're dealing with a lot of things, and we want to make sure that you're doing what you need to do. Keep us updated when you need to. But regardless of how frequently they would like to be updated or informed of the developments of the case, I think one thing is true uniformly is, we respect them enough to be honest with them. We tell them from the get-go, what challenges may come in a case. Joe, in Pennsylvania and many other states, there's a workers' compensation system, as obviously Sonny knows, which compensates the injured victim, but does not permit that injured victim to sue the employer. So that may be an issue in a case. There may be certain issues in cases where we have enough respect for our clients when they want that information to be honest with them, and, appropriately set the expectations, because, we need to be able to inform them. We need them to be able to ask us questions, because if we don't have that open dialogue from the beginning, you might be 2 or 3 years down the road and they might not really know that, their case could go to trial, or what that really means for them, that they have to sit in a courtroom for 2 or 3 weeks and live this accident day in and day out every single day. So, from an expectation management in terms of the recovery, but more importantly, in terms of the process, how long it may take, you know, what the end results may be, and actually going to trial and having your case heard by jurors. It's something we need to tell them, you know, as early as possible, so that, you know, they have a clear understanding of what they're getting themselves into. Because litigation, you know, it's not a fun process for the people involved. You know, they've already dealt with something major and catastrophic, you know, and we try to make sure that we're doing the work that is necessary on our end to, you know, make sure that they focus on their recovery. But it is a process that they need to know, you know, what they're in store for.
Right. And for most clients, this is their first time being exposed to litigation. So it is important to keep those lines of communication open. And I also tell my clients at the initial client meeting that they're a partner in the litigation. I'm not doing this by myself. I need their help. I need their insight. So if you keep those lines of communication open, I think that they're going to be more inclined to tell you things that they might not otherwise tell you.
David, you mentioned you started off your career on the defense side, as a lot of great attorneys do. How does that benefit you when you're talking to your client? When you're, you know, you're getting put through to you, they may be standard, you know, strategies and tactics that the defense attorneys and the insurance companies are pulling, but the client doesn't understand that, and it could probably throw them for a loop fairly quickly. How much has that benefited you now that obviously over the last 20 plus years of representing the plaintiff?
I like to think that it still has a benefit. I like to think that I'm still able to put myself into the position of a defense lawyer, Joe, to think about a case, to think about a series of facts, a story, and how that is likely to be heard by the insurance company that ultimately is going to be the payer if there's going to be a settlement. And it's not necessarily something that I will affirmatively say to every client, but I know that when I'm talking with a client and saying, look, here's what I'm seeing. I think our best offense is on this theory, on this theory, on that theory. I think where the defense is going to press is on A, B, and C. I've got a pretty good idea of where the defense is going to press because I was in that chair and I spent 8.5 years there and I tried cases as a defense lawyer and have a pretty good sense for where they're going to be coming from. At the same time, it was because, I don't know if you know this about me, I reached a point of having like an existential crisis as a defense lawyer where I was going to defense lawyer conferences and listening to the way in which they talked about plaintiffs, about claimants, and I didn't feel comfortable. And I was like, yeah, I don't think I feel comfortable in this environment. I don't think that this is for me. No. And that's what led me to being drawn when one of the partners here reached out to me back in 1998, beginning of 1999, and said, do you want to come do this? I was like, yeah.
Yeah.
Because that's just much more me. Is your being on the side of injured workers than being on the side of insurance?
Absolutely.
Companies.
Is your defense background particularly useful before the case gets into litigation when you're dealing with the adjusters?
Great question. I don't know about how you do this at this point. I very, very rarely deal with adjusters or even attempt to try to end with my team for a while. I think it's a key expectation to set.
It's interesting because we've talked about it a lot when it comes to insurance companies and the fact that as much as something, you know, seems open and shut, you know, ironically, you see these TV commercials and, you know, it's everybody smiling, right, flow, and the whole gang is there on the beach, right? That's where I'm getting my insurance. I'm just unless you actually got to use the insurance.
You don't believe flow has your back, Jeff?
Yeah, I'll tell you. Or you know, Liberty Bibbity and all, the whole crew there, right? Only what you need. But having said that, why do you think, somebody's worked their whole entire life for a company. They've worked incredibly hard. Something happens, and then all of a sudden they become an adversary. It could be a tragic type situation. Is that typically the norm in an adversarial situation? Have you ever run into a situation where you had, somebody from across the table? And in a lot of ways, David, this is kind of what you're talking about when you go to those conferences. I've had defense attorneys on the shows. I just had one the other day, and she came in, into the broadcast, and no one knows what happened to her since. Just kidding. But my point is, it all of a sudden becomes adversarial, no matter how, simple it seems, cut and dry. Bob,
is this a trick question?
Yeah, well, I'm just saying, do you ever get any warmth? Is there ever anybody goes, yeah, it was our fault?
When money's involved, it's going to be adversarial.
Yeah, I mean, what's the deal there? You get insurance because something like this happened.
You would think.
Yeah. You know what I mean?
Like, you would think.
I mean, but David, you mentioned that the courthouse steps, it often happens. They have to know. I've heard this 100 times. With a firm like Saltzman-Gallucci, they know you're going the distance. It's not a joke. They know you're going to go to the end. Why? I guess it's about getting interest on their money. They don't want to give it up to the last minute. I mean, is there ever a sense, have you ever run into a situation where it was so obvious that they just said, we're going to settle this in a couple weeks. I don't know.
Few and far between. It's happened. And to Dave's point, I think there are a few exceptions where pre-suit discussions could be beneficial. If there are certain, confidential issues that may, benefit the parties to resolving a case before it gets out in the media, you might be able to, resolve a case pre-suit and to the benefit for your client. But, to Dave's point, insurance companies and adjusters, they're not looking at their files thinking to themselves, which ones can I pay out today? They're looking at how can I not pay these claims? How can I not compensate these people who are filing a lawsuit? And to Dave's point, it's about the threat of trial. And until we can really, put their feet to the fire and say, you know what, if we're not going to resolve this case, we're going to trial, they're not going to do anything. They're not going to give you the top dollar. And ultimately, the reason that we pursue every single case and when we litigate every case, we're assuming that case is going to go to trial. Now, not everyone does. The vast majority don't. But the fact that we actually work them up that way is what allows us to get the fair value for our clients and frankly, exceed, some expectations, when we put the cases in that type of posture.
Sonny, with workers' compensation, you're dealing often with individuals that are immediately getting denied or disputed when they have several witnesses, including the owner of the company, who stood right there and watched, something fall off a truck and hit the individual.
Sure, and in my practice, I'm dealing with adjusters on a regular basis because, a lot of times the case isn't anywhere near litigation when I get a client. They may have denied the case, and it seems obvious that the injury happened at work and that the person is disabled, so I'll try to resolve it before actually putting it in suit. Or the client may already be on compensation, and I'm just monitoring the case until the insurance company initiate litigation.
But you hear terms all the time, pre-existing injury, light duty, what somebody who's working on the docks. Okay, I mean, clearly there's no light duty for an iron worker. And by the way, the other guys on the job don't want to see it. And somebody's got to help me with this bucket of bolts. I mean, my point is.
And, there's no real pre-existing injury in
of course.
In the law.
Of course, I know it, and I'm an iron worker.
Because an aggravation of a pre-existing condition is just as good as
exactly.
A brand new injury.
But I'm saying the deception.
Adjusters and defense counsel all the time saying, this pre-existed the injury. There's no way it has any relationship to what happened at work.
Before we go to break, Bob, talk about the importance of having the resources to be able to fight these cases and investigate these, and why attorneys from all across the country refer cases to Saltzman-Gallucci.
I think Dave and I are both blessed. We have the responsibility of working for clients and families who truly need our help. And I say this, to my team, this is the biggest asset and the biggest issue that our clients will ever face in their lives. You know, so I try not to just think about them as cases that I'm handling, but the clients that I'm working for. And, you know, Dave and I on our cases, you know, we're responsible for making tough decisions, making decisions on which experts to select, you know, where are these experts going to be coming from, you know, how many depositions need to be taken of coworkers and corporate designees. You know, so we have to be responsible and make sure that we are leaving no stone unturned and also spending the client's money wisely, because these case costs can be, you know, exceptionally high.
Yeah, you say that. Ironically, we're going to push the brake off a little bit, but they're not putting money out of their pocket, correct?
No.
So let's talk about that, because, you know, David, you know, I'm sure, you know, you've worked on some massive cases, and the process of hiring experts and all those, that is not out of pocket costs up front from the client, correct?
No, these are not upfront costs that we expect the client to handle in any way, shape, or form. And what winds up happening is we're essentially fronting the costs of the litigation, often for 3, 4, 5, sometimes more years, often at a cost of $250,000, sometimes $500,000, if that is what is necessary for the case. But Bob's point about the importance of our being stewards for the client's money never ever stops. So even though when we want to do a case and we go to Mongoloozy and say, here's the case, we want to do the case, okay, if we spend $200,000, from the moment that he says yes, that's client money, because we know that both during the case and at the end of the case, we have to justify exactly why we spent every penny of the client's money, because that's otherwise money that's going back to the client.
Sure.
I got to think about that. I got to be careful with that. I got to make sure every single dime that I spend is justified, because ultimately that's money that comes out of the client's pocket.
And you're looking at value in a case. I've heard attorneys say to me several times, plenty of times, you know, it was a case, but it wasn't a case that would be worth the client themselves going through it, because it would cost too much to kind of put it together. Having said that, how do you value a case? In other words, there's got to be a lot of factors, especially a 4 to 5 year case that is going to be that, you know, you're going to have a fight on your hands, and you know you're going to have to hire experts. You have to estimate, you know, I guess, what the potential settlement value of that case is, and you better be right.
And I'm curious when you feel comfortable valuing the case.
You know, that's a great point. I mean, I think it's an art, it's not a science. And we meet every week as attorneys, and, you know, we discuss the values of the cases. You know, we do internal presentations where we bring up the plaintiffs, our arguments, we bring up the defense arguments, you know, and we ask other attorneys at the firm, you know, what they believe the value of the case is, because I don't think anybody has a crystal ball. What we try to do is figure out what number would be more appealing than our client going in front of a jury. And that's really the equation, is there a number that would be more palatable in a settlement than taking your chances with 12 jurors? And, you know, at the end of the day, I can tell you, even with our internal process, if we have 25 lawyers who are analyzing a case, you're not going to get the exact same number 25 times. It just doesn't happen. So everyone brings their own, you know, internal philosophies. They bring their experiences. You know, but the benefit we have is we've handled certain types of cases enough times where either through prior verdicts or settlements, we can kind of base what this client case may be worth based upon precedent, based upon the facts of that case, based upon the positives and negatives that we might see from certain witnesses. You know, so to your point, Sonny, you know, I think we have to have an idea of case value throughout the case, because otherwise we'd have a really difficult time in figuring out what costs should be incurred on a case. You can't spend the same money on a back injury, rear-end car accident as you would for a death case or someone who's been paralyzed in an accident.
Right.
You know, so we have to have a general sense, and through the case, value can change. You know, we can have a great deposition. We can get some great documents that we uncover, and that could increase the value of the case over time. So it's a fluid process, one that I think, frankly, our collaborative approach at our firm allows us to get really valuable insight from, you know, dozens of attorneys.
Well, that's exactly, I was going to say that. That's got to be such huge. A resource, you know, being able to, I mean, how many, you said?
We're probably around 35 lawyers or so, and we all have different backgrounds. Dave was a defense lawyer. We have one lawyer who was doing insurance coverage work for over a decade. So she brings that knowledge. We've got former prosecutors. So when there are cases involving criminal elements, if there's a sexual assault or if there is a drunk driving accident, you know, everyone brings their own, you know, experiences. And to have 25, 30, 35 really great lawyers telling you what they think of the strengths and weaknesses of a case, it really makes you think about it. And frankly, I think it makes us better lawyers in judging, you know, what we would feel comfortable recommending to the client. Now, at the end of the day, it's the client's decision. The client gets to decide if they want to take a settlement, if offered, or go to trial. Our job is to give them very well-reasoned recommendations and hopefully allow them to see why we're making those recommendations. But at the end of the day, if the client wants to go to trial or doesn't, they're going to make that decision.
I have a question. Is the client involved in the valuation process at all?
I think everybody handles it a little differently.
Really?
It's a subject I like to put off until a little bit later in the case, because you don't know what documents you might uncover. You don't know how great a deposition may be. I mean, facts do change over time. If you say a number early on in the case, that number is something that the client will just latch on to no matter what. And frankly, you know, the value may increase. And, you know, they may not understand, well, you told me X. Why are you now saying I shouldn't take X?
Right.
Well, that's because we just found out, you know, issues 1, 2, and 3. So I like to personally get an understanding of what the client's expectations are, what they would be satisfied with in terms of a settlement, you know, a net settlement, what they would walk away with. And then I normally give them my thoughts and feedback. I've had clients who their expectations were lower than where I think they should have been. I also have clients whose expectations are higher than where I think the case may be valued.
How often does a client's personal situation, especially during COVID, now, so you know, somebody you know whose wife or husband was working, and all of a sudden gets laid off, and now all of a sudden a great case that they have, you know, they may, you know, now all of a sudden, you know, they're stressed even more than they were. How often does that become a factor in impacting the potential you know, value of a case if they just can't wait it out? How do you typically deal with a situation like that?
We're fortunate that many of our clients do have the workers' compensation system to fall back on. So Sonny or another workers' compensation.
There is no other workers' compensation. Yeah.
Thank you, Joe.
I'm just kidding.
Hopefully just Sonny. We'll have the workers' compensation side of a case, and that will allow, hopefully, the client to be able to withstand 2, 3, 4, 5 years of a litigation process.
Sure.
You know, for the non-workplace accident cases, that can be a factor.
Yeah.
You know, there are needs and there are realities. And, you know, for a client, you know, there has to be some consideration of what is a settlement worth now versus going to trial a year or two from now.
Sure.
And if you get a good verdict at trial, maybe waiting another 2 or 3 years to go through the appellate process. So, you know, thankfully, there is a system for injured workers where they can receive some workers' compensation. You know, I always like to have really open dialogue and communication with the workers' compensation attorney. I've called Sonny countless times on cases.
And vice versa.
We're working with the clients together.
And he answered for you?
You know, picks up every time.
What the heck, Sonny? having said that, the culture, because I want to spotlight and let people understand you know, the difference of what and why Mongoluzzi is, you know, such a, you know, high level firm. And I say that, talk about the culture of the attorneys at the firm. If you did to describe, what it takes to be an attorney here at Saltz Mongoluzzi, you know, what are the expectations? Not too many guys, you know, hanging out at watching video games in their office. I know you guys work incredibly hard. But the culture likely has to start the day you walk in, with the individuals at the hiring hall. In other words, if you want to come to Mongoloosie, qualities.
I think Dave hit the nail on the head with respect to this question. I think that most of the attorneys here are scouted. They're scoped out by other attorneys here. They see them in practice, in operation, and they're asked to come on board.
Gentlemen?
I think that you're absolutely right. We do work very, very hard here. We also play real hard when we have a chance to play.
That's the next segment there, David.
Okay, we're on the play stuff. Got it. But what I was going to say is, number one, I think that we are looking for individuals who, like sharks, can smell a couple droplets of blood in 500,000 gallons of seawater.
Sure.
Right? And to me, one of the watchwords is something that Mongoloosie said to me from the very first time that I interviewed with him before I even agreed in May of 99 to come on board, right? Because Mongoloosie's watchwords are, when you got them by the balls, don't forget to squeeze.
You remind one of the great interviews on TV.
Put that on my business card.
I know. Well, I think first of all, it's fantastic. What's that movie? Me and Dupree,
Jim Carrey.
Yeah, I forget the two brothers. But he goes like this. He's in the interview. He's trying to get a job. And he says, "Do you work on Columbus Day?" Now this isn't the guy interview. And he goes, "Yeah, we do." He goes, "Well, we tried. Didn't work out." That's not here. But I say that because you have a competitive atmosphere and you work incredibly hard. And if I'm a client and if my life's on the line, that's what the hell I want to hear. I want to hear, I'll give you an example. I'm doing an event tonight, and the attorney that's handling we do a lot of legal radio, obviously, and the attorney that's handling the nonprofit, that human being will never get a job at Salts Mongoloosie just by the nature of the voicemail that I actually, I remember going, I guess, oh my God. And I say that because you want somebody who is passionate, aggressive, and all those things, and at the same time has a caring bone in their body. Now, I say, your staff, that person right out there, it's as important as anybody because that's the face of your place.
And, okay. And when we walked in, she made it a point to greet each one of us.
She did. And my point is, you just don't find individuals like that walking on Market Street. You have to vet them. You don't get, and that process has to start in a lot of ways at HR because, somebody can sneak through, but all of a sudden, if did you see Ringo around? I figure there's no Ringos here around you. All of a sudden, golfing again, that culture, the culture of competition and just wanting to represent your client with ferocity, is that catchy? In other words, is that the culture that is with the firm, and is it a competitive in a good type of way?
I don't see it as being competitive with our partners. I think we're competitive for our partners, and I think that when I see Dave getting a great result or working hard, or when I see him here on the weekends, it makes me want to work even harder. It makes me want to do better for my clients. And ultimately, there is a competitive spirit where, a lot of us, we like sports, we like competition, and we bring it, in our cases. You talk about culture. There are 35 fantastic lawyers here. And, each of them, they really, you said it, they care about the cases. That's the number one issue is, do you care about the cases? Do you care about the clients? Because, you can't do this if you just consider it a job. It's a career. Well, and it's something that, you need to just give your entire, your entire attention to and detail and really make sure that, I'm working as hard as the next person here, because we've all got clients who desperately need our help.
Does that start at the top? Because
absolutely.
I'll tell you, and I say that because the number one, you know, the number one complaint for clients with lawyers in general is they can never get in touch with them. Mm-hmm. That's about the last thing that's going to happen at this firm. And like you said, you know, it has to start in a corner office.
Yeah, I mean, my clients have my cell phone number. You know, they know that they can get in touch with me. In fact, I was just texting with one of them before we started. And when it comes to, you know, top down, you know, Dave and I have both tried cases with Bob Mongaluzzi and Larry Bendesky. You know, I know that when I'm getting here on a Saturday or a Sunday during trial, you know, Bob Mongaluzzi is probably going to beat me here. And I keep trying to beat him, but, you know, it just doesn't work out. I'm here, you know, at 6:45. He'll get here at 6:30 in the morning. I mean, he's someone where when he is just, you know, immersed in a case, you know, that is his life. And, you know, it's like that for all of us. When we're in trial mode, you know, there's not really anything else we're thinking about other than how are we going to, you know, compete and work for this client. Because they only get one shot at trial. You don't get a do-over. You don't get to, you know, pick a new lawyer or try again with a new judge. You get one shot.
David, how often do other attorneys refer cases to this firm?
Oh, very frequently. That's something that's happening every day. In fact, every hour of every day. And I think that that is a testament to the reputation that we've built, which is based upon the results that we have gotten. And I think that it's that straightforward. But one of the things that is essential in what we do is energy and is passion. Because as important as it is to be ready for trial and to pursue a trial and to do it successfully and intelligently and deftly, what we do requires that you show up every single day with energy and passion. To go back to your earlier point, it happens almost never that a defendant raises his hand, stands up and says, yeah, my bad, this is on me, let me make it right. That's a world I wished I lived in,
sure.
But I don't. To get anything done, I gotta be on the other guy every hour of every day. Give me this, give me this, give me this. I asked you yesterday, I asked you last week, I asked you last month, we gotta get this done. If you're not gonna get back to me, eventually I'm gonna go to the court, I'm gonna make you answer the question, answer the request that I have posed. It is that sort of energy. It's about relentlessness, right? In order to do what we do, to succeed the way that we succeed, you gotta be relentless. You have to absolutely have no quit in you, and that's it.
Talk about, we got about 10 minutes left. We're not going to break.
now you tell us, Joe.
Well, I say that because it's just some of the high-profile cases that you guys have had, you know, the duck boat cases and the you know, there's a lot of them, and it never ceases, you know, to amaze me. I'm never surprised that you are representing those cases, and a lot of those cases come from other states, and I mean halfway across the country, if not all the way across the country. Talk about that type of confidence that, you know, and responsibility it takes to take those cases to another level. Especially when they're in the media, right there. Talk about the different elements and something like that.
You know, you bring up kind of national cases. I mean, I'm
the whole world's watching.
I'm trying a case in 6 weeks in Iowa. You know, Dave is a chair of the National Crane and Aerial Lift division of the National Trial Lawyers. So, you know, when it comes to national work, we appreciate it and we take it as a real responsibility. You know, when there's any media involved in a case, you have to make sure that you are working for your client's interests, not just to be in the media, but for a specific purpose. You know, we have a case that we just recently put into suit involving a gun manufacturer. And that gun manufacturer has, we allege, injured a lot of people with their gun that we believe is defective. So we put out a media release, and ultimately many news organizations started covering this issue. It was on Good Morning America about 2 or 3 weeks ago. It was on Nightline before that. And what happened was, you know, we represent a lot of officers, a lot of both federally and local officers who've been injured by their gun. Many of them, when it happened, it was a discharge without the trigger being pulled. They thought to themselves, well, it's just me. And, you know, I'm the only person that this happened to. And, you know, maybe it was something that I did. But, you know, you hear a second one, and you hear about a third, and you hear about five, and then you hear about 10. And, you know, it makes our clients and, frankly, other people realize that this is not a they problem. It's not a them problem. It's a problem with the gun. So, you know, we try to strategically utilize a relationship with the media to bring out issues of importance in our cases and make sure that those issues are being spotlighted.
David, high profile cases, we do something called Case Watch. Any cases that have impacted you especially in a special way that maybe, you know, stuck with you for a long time, motivated you, and something that you know, taught you and gave you incentive to move forward?
I can't help but think, Joe, about the most horrific accident that I have seen. And so this was for the family of a tradesperson, and it happened just right nearby in Delaware County. It was an 11-year-old boy who, for the very, very first time, was on a go-kart. And it was a commercially manufactured go-kart by one of the large go-kart manufacturers. It was not, you know, from a kit or something that had been heavily modified or, you know, a junky piece of equipment at all. And unfortunately, this boy had never operated this kind of equipment, was not given a helmet, was not given instructions. Okay. And the family friend who took him to drive the go-kart made a pretty poor choice of where to set up. So there was a construction trailer, a low boy, and this little boy got under the low boy, and it did horrible, horrible things to his head. Jeez. The amount of grief, the amount of loss that goes along with some of the cases that we handle are a chilling reminder of just how fragile human life is and just how important safety is, because there are designs for go-karts that this company's competitors were using that absolutely prevent what happened to this boy from occurring. And as I think about your question, and I think about that young man, I remember his name. I don't know that we should be using names, but I think about some of the child cases that we handle. Those are the things that make me say, as a dad and as a human being, I've got to not just give this my very best. I've got to go beyond my very best.
And it's interesting because, and we only have a couple minutes left, but Sonny, you're not only going, you know, for justice and you know, you're not, you know, for monetary judgment, but also for change. That's where it happens, in the courtroom.
And does the possibility of effectuating change come into the, or enter into the vetting process?
Oh,
before you take a case?
Absolutely. And we have made changes. There are machines that are now safer because of us, because of cases that we have brought. There are companies that no longer make those products because of lawsuits.
It's interesting because every time I hear a tractor trailer out in front of my house, when you hear beep, beep, beep,
right.
I don't know the case, but I know it was an attorney that made that happen. It's the truth.
Or every time you go to open a medicine bottle.
Yeah, exactly.
I know an attorney was behind that.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, blame us.
I was just going to say, especially when I can't open it. Gentlemen, this has been the fastest hour in radio.
Extremely enjoyable.
Absolutely. We can't thank yous enough for being our guests. I want to thank everybody for tuning into the Lawyer to Lawyer Network. I want to thank Andrew Walker for putting it together. Of course, we want to thank David Quas and Bob Zimmerman for inviting us to here to this location. We could get used to this, huh, Sonny?
Absolutely, man.
I want to thank David, if you would, contact information if somebody wants to get in touch.
Best way to get in touch with us is by calling the firm at 215-496 8686. Is that right?
8282.
Oh, 8282.
8282.
Thank you.
I caught them off guard here, Peter.
Yeah, wow.
I should have read that. But have and Bob, closing words.
Yeah, I mean, I'll just say, you know, anyone can reach me by email, rzimmerman@smbb.com. You know, I really appreciate you having us on. I appreciate the opportunity, you know, to learn from Sonny and hear things about his workers' comp cases. Because there is a connection with what we do and what Sonny does.
There's definitely a synergy.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, and it's always great to hear from you, Joe, and you know, your experiences in the trades.
Absolutely. Sonny, take us home.
Joe, Banks Law, 215-561-1000. Our web address is www.bankslaw.com.
All right. I want to thank everybody for tuning into the Lawyer to Lawyer Network. We appreciate everybody on the broadcast. For everybody on the panel, I'm Joe Dougherty. Thanks for listening.